Hi, everyone. I'm happy to invite you to our third panel on TB vaccines. Our moderator today is Dr. Ginsberg. She's the Vice President of ERAS, or Scientific Affairs at ERAS, and she has a wide experience on TB. Her main role is to oversee the strategic relationship with major entrepreneurs in TB vaccine development, and some of them are here. So I would like to introduce Dr. Adam Stoddard, the General Manager of OATC, Oxford Emergent Consortium on Tuberculosis. Dr. Zonggong Li, the CEO and President of Shanghai Biotech. And Dr. Suresh Jadhav, the Vice President of Serum Institute of India. Please join me in welcoming our panel.
Thank you, Diana. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's an extremely well-organized meeting, and I want to thank Julia and the other organizers for their hard work and for including me in this interesting day. So as you've heard, we're going to tell you a bit about TB vaccines from the perspectives of a number of different organizations involved. And I'm going to just spend a couple of minutes at the beginning sort of setting the context. The broader context of TB was brilliantly set by the previous panel, so I thank them for that. And I'll tell you a bit about the need for TB vaccines and then about the organization I work for, ERAS. So you've heard about the epidemic itself, but why do we still have a growing TB epidemic when there's been an effective, supposedly, vaccine against TB since 1921? The current vaccine, Bacille Calmette-Guerin, named for these two gentlemen who developed it back in the early part of the 1900s. It was first used in 1921 and is the most widely used vaccine in the world. It's estimated that over 3 billion doses have been given since 1921, largely through the WHO EPI program. It's delivered largely to newborns around the world. But despite that, as you've heard, there are about a third of the world infected with Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacterium that causes TB, nearly 9 million new cases of TB every year and 1.4 million deaths. So obviously this vaccine is not doing the job that's needed. It does reduce the risk of severe pediatric disease when given to newborns, particularly extrapulmonary forms of TB, which are most common in that population. However, it's extremely unreliable in its ability to protect against adult pulmonary TB, which, as you heard eloquently from Chris Dye, is really the bulk of the morbidity and mortality of this epidemic. Not known to have any ability to protect against latent TB infection, which, again, is an issue for about a third of the world and is a huge reservoir of future cases of active TB disease. And it's not recommended for infants who are HIV positive because they can get a systemic BCGosis or BCG infection. So what BCG really does is just protect against this small bit of the overall need for an effective TB vaccine. The potential for new TB vaccines, safer, more effective ones, would be that they could prevent TB in children, adolescents, and adults, whether or not those individuals were HIV positive. That's sort of the brass ring. As we discussed in the previous panel, an effective new TB vaccine should also be able to protect not only against drug-sensitive TB, but against the many forms of drug-resistant TB. And there's no reason to think that a vaccine that was effective against drug-sensitive TB wouldn't work equally well against drug-resistant forms. An effective, safe vaccine would reduce, obviously, the enormous cost and burden of TB that you heard about in the previous panel. It would reduce the cost of taking care of TB patients on healthcare systems and on national economies. As you heard, India alone probably loses on the order of $14, $15 billion a year because of TB. And obviously would be a key factor in the ultimate ability to eliminate TB as a public health problem. So ERAS was founded in 2003 largely with the mission to develop safer, more effective TB vaccines to serve this unmet medical need. It's located in the United States in Rockville, Maryland, and has an office in Cape Town, South Africa as well. It's essentially a not-for-profit biotechnology organization doing everything, from discovery through GMP manufacture, clinical development, clinical trials, and ultimately regulatory approval. And when we get to that day, could also do post-approval trials. And as you will see, an equally important part of its mission is to assure access throughout the world. So how does it work? ARIS is really an example of a group of organizations. There are 15, maybe up to two dozen of these product development partnerships that have formed over the last decade or 15 years. These are not-for-profit product development organizations, which have a variety of different business models. Some are almost totally virtual. Others, like ARIS and IAVI, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, are much more bricks-and-mortar organizations. But they all gather funding from both public and private sources. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a major source of funding for most of the organizations, including ARIS. But they try to bring in the expertise that's needed to solve whichever neglected disease tool they're trying to develop from wherever they can be found. So ARIS partners with everybody from academic organizations and institutions to large pharmaceutical companies, biotech companies, governments, foundations, clinical research organizations. Wherever we can get the expertise that will help move a project forward, that's where we look for it. We could do the whole pipeline ourselves if needed, but we'd much rather join forces with others, both to get absolutely the best expertise across the world and to leverage others' resources and marshal ours for yet other projects. So over the last decade or so, the global TB vaccine community has built the beginnings of a robust pipeline of TB vaccine candidates. There are a dozen now, roughly, in the clinic. And half of those are in the ARIS pipeline as well, each one partnered with at least one or multiple other organizations, as you can see. There's one candidate, which is a mycobacterial derivative, which is in phase 3 in India. This candidate actually has been demonstrated in India to have some efficacy against leprosy and is now being tested against TB. But the two most advanced in the ARIS pipeline, and aside from MW in the global pipeline, are in phase 2B. These are sort of late-stage proof-of-concept trials, so they've moved to a very exciting stage, really a turning point in development now, where we'll see if they actually work over the next couple of years. One of them you'll hear about in detail from Dr. Stoughton from the Oxford Emergent TB Consortium, and the other is a partnership between ARIS and Crucell to develop an adenovirus vectored vaccine. As I said, the challenges only start at the R&D side of the pipeline, and really at least half the challenge, if not more, of ultimate success comes at the far end when you actually have a candidate that's been shown to be safe and effective, and you have to ensure that it gets to the populations that really need it. So we refer to these as the AAA challenges, challenges of access, adoption, and affordability. I hope in our panel today you'll hear about both the R&D challenges and some of these access and affordability challenges. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through them in any detail, but would be happy to discuss them in the Q&A. If that's of interest. So these are ARIS's major donors, to whom we're enormously grateful, of course. And now I'd like to turn it over to our distinguished guests on the panel, and we'll start with Adam Stoughton, who, as you've heard, is the Deputy General Manager of the Oxford Emergent TB Consortium, and we'll talk about the candidate MVA-85A. Adam?
Thanks very much, Anne. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you also very much to Julia for organising this excellent event and extending the invitation to OTC to participate. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of OTC, really what we're trying to achieve and the business model that we've created to do so. So OETC is a joint venture formed back in 2008 between the University of Oxford and the UK subsidiary of Emergent Biosolutions, a US vaccine development company. And really, we have a very simple purpose. We seek to protect life by developing and commercialising TB vaccines based on this candidate, MVA-85A, that originated from Oxford. We also have some very clear objectives. To, firstly, complete a phase 2B study in infants that Anne mentioned. Secondly, to complete development of a robust, scalable commercial manufacturing process that will be able to meet the likely demand for a new TB vaccine. And we're using for this an avian cell line process. And then thirdly, to progress the evaluation of the vaccine in other indications, particularly in HIV-infected adults and in healthy adolescents and young adults. So what is MVA-85A, other than clearly being untouched by branding consultants to date? It's an attenuated, i.e. weakened viral vector that expresses one of the major antigens from the TB bacterium. And it's really designed to act as a boost to BCG. So we're not seeking to replace BCG in the schedules, instead we're seeking to boost it. And we know from preclinical studies that the vaccine is able to significantly improve BCG-induced protection in a range of models. And we also know from fairly extensive clinical evaluation to date that it is both well-tolerated and also able to induce the right, well, what we hope are the right kind of immune responses in a range of different age groups, and also, very importantly, in HIV-infected and latent TB-infected adults. Again, as I mentioned, we're at a very exciting phase of development now. The vaccine is in two phase 2B trials, and these are the first trials that we hope will demonstrate that the potent immune responses that we know this vaccine can generate will translate into protective efficacy. The first of these is in infants in South Africa, and we'll get a result from that right at the end of this year. And then the second trial in HIV-infected adults in South Africa and Senegal will yield results sometime in 2015. So to move on to the OETC business model, perhaps it's best to rewind 5 or 6 years to the University of Oxford, which at that point was really facing a challenge in that it had this incredibly exciting and potentially valuable vaccine candidate asset. But how could it really translate that into a commercially viable product? And it was very clear that we needed to bring in a commercial partner of some description. And in fact, our initial discussions with potential partners focused far more on simply out-licensing this technology, so handing it over as a package to a third party to develop. But as these discussions with partners progressed, and particularly with Emergent, it became clear that there was actually a very strong rationale for looking at a different approach. And so the concept of a joint venture was born. And really the underlying philosophy for the JV was to provide a repository for all of the ingredients that you need for successful TB vaccine development and commercialization. And so that was the approach that we took. And this diagram really depicts the kind of contributions of the parties. So the top left from Oxford, there was a contribution of the intellectual property around the vaccine, of funding that had been channeled into Oxford to support the program from the Wellcome Trust and also from the European Developing Countries Clinical Trials Partnership. But also there was the scientific and clinical expertise that resided within the institution. And then from Emergent in the red circle, we had a contribution, firstly, of significant funding, and then secondly, of, I guess, general commercial vaccine development expertise. And probably this was most important around manufacturing and process development. So these are the contributions into the JV, but at the same time, we wanted to really map out a path forward to commercialise and deliver the vaccine to markets that needed it. And so we put in place two additional agreements. The first was, again, with Emergent, and it gave Emergent the exclusive rights to commercialise and sell the vaccine in the developed world. In parallel, we put in place an agreement with ARAS, under which ARIS received rights to develop or commercialise and distribute the vaccine in the developing world. And in response, for the provision of these rights, ARIS was able to provide funding towards our infant phase 2B study and also access to the clinical trial site in South Africa, which at the time really was the only place that one could conduct a large-scale TB vaccine efficacy study. So what's not shown on this particular slide are the myriad of other partnerships and relationships that OETC acts as a focal point for. And in terms of looking to the future, this joint venture arrangement provides us with significant flexibility in terms of bringing on board new partners, potentially even as shareholders. So in terms of the future, we're very much planning for success at this stage. We've got data, our first efficacy data, due end of this year. And as part of planning for that, we're really looking to build consensus within the TB field around what we see as some critical issues, particularly gating criteria, and within that, the issue of acceptable levels of efficacy to really progress this vaccine into phase 3 trials for licensure and ultimately to implementation. And in fact, we have some fairly recent interesting reference points here, most notably the malaria vaccine that GSK is developing, which, depending on quite how you look at it, is approximately 50% efficacious, and this does look likely to be taken forward. We also face some logistical challenges in terms of simply the global capacity to support large phase 3 efficacy studies. A lot of work's been done by organisations like ARAS, like EDCTP, and indeed the Wellcome Trust, in building up this kind of capacity in Africa. But in terms of progressing the entire pipeline of TB vaccines, this still remains a challenge. And indeed, outside of Africa, where the incidence rates are a lot lower, the logistics of conducting efficacy studies are significant. It's also very clear that, as with diagnostics and drugs, we need probably increased public funding support to progress both our vaccine and also the wider portfolio. And I just wanted to draw attention to one particular mechanism, which we have certainly benefited from to date, and this is EDCTP, the European Developing Countries Clinical Trials Partnership. And in fact, the second generation of EDCTP is currently under review by the European Commission and Member States with a view to, subject to approval, becoming live in 2014. And it's really critical that these kinds of mechanisms, along with funders like the Wellcome Trust and ARAS, are supported to really enable the delivery of these vaccines to those most in need. So finally, I'll just leave you with an image of the 1,000th infant vaccinated in our phase 2B trial in South Africa. This trial is now fully enrolled, just shy of 2,800 subjects, and we very much look forward to updating you on the results of this trial probably very early next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. That was great and a very nice example of how one of the most advanced candidates is moving forward through an innovative partnership. Our next presentation will be by Dr. Li, who's president and CEO of Shanghai H&G Biotechnology.
So what I'm going to tell you today is the immunotherapy of MDR patients with DNA vaccine in conjunction with first-line anti-TB drugs. It is very cheap. The second line is very expensive. My background. The company's name, H&G, what that means? Actually, from Chinese, Hai Gui, the spelling. We use the first letter or second letter, H&G. But second meaning is high quality and good service. So I came to the United States in 1986 as postdoc training at the CBER of FDA, doing regulatory work and research work on pertussis vaccine. A couple years later, a cellular pertussis was licensed in the United States. In 1993, I with my boss, Dr. Brennan, now he's worked at ARIS with Anne as well, to work from pertussis division to microbacteria division. And in 1994, the NIH had the first conference on DNA vaccine. At that time, the scientists were very happy. I hope the DNA vaccine could be replaced the traditional vaccine to the second generation of the vaccine. But I think it is possible. After working on the DNA vaccine on the mice model for a couple of years in NIH and FDA, and in 2002, I quit my job back to China. I have a company found in 2003, and I take my angel money, $100,000, and the local government match up one-to-one match funding. So this is my initial funding for my company at the very beginning. And my mission tried to recent development therapeutic DNA vaccine and object to reduce the mortality of MDR-TB. Main reasons for returning to China. I work at FDA. FDA is a regulatory agency. Now can support me to make DNA vaccine available. I've made transfer to GSK or Sanofi Pasteur or Malio, but I have to leave. Second, the number of patients in the U.S. is limited. It's not possible to do clinical trial in the United States. And the multiple center trial centers are needed. And Arrows and some agents, they did a lot of job in South Africa to have the vaccine trial site incubated so many years. But we know a good vaccine not only be effective in Africa, but also should be effective in China, India, Russia. Then we can control the disease worldwide. So we'll try to China to be another center, potentially, by doing research on the vaccines. And the high burden TB China second, just beside India, China, is very high in some TBs. And another regulatory agency, LU, is biologics need to be made in China for control. Not like drugs, the small chemical. You can make outside China, you can do clinical trial in China, but the biologics are different. You need to be physically made in China, then you can do the clinical trial in China. The funding investment in infectious disease from central local government have been keeping increase since 2003. Why? The SARS attack, 2003, the big loss in China. The Chinese government realized the three diseases need to be faced with: HIV, tuberculosis, and hepatitis, not malaria. Malaria problem, Africa, not in China. So these three main diseases, the government put a lot of attention, a lot of financial support for this main infectious disease. Challenges we are facing. In 2008, there are 440,000 cases of MDR-TB, but by 2005, there will be about 2 million. Like Shirley mentioned in her talk. Almost 50% was in India and China. The second line anti-TB drugs are not affordable for developed countries. The China, only Shanghai, the government this year can got free treatment of second line anti-TB drug. The rest of every China still have to pay by patient. So the fake are drug resistant, they have to die because no drug to treat them. The government not affordable to give them high cost for the second line anti-TBs. So immunotherapy for MDR-TB, conjunction with first anti-TB drugs, may be possible to treat portion of the MDR-TB patients. So plasmid DNA can initiate both humoral and cellular immunity and confer therapeutic effects on TB in animal models. What the plasmid DNA? It is plasmid with a gene inside with the same gene as Adam mentioned in Oxford, is 85A. The gene injected into the muscle and the gene expressed in the inside the cells that stimulate the immune system to generate immune system. But what you realized, the DNA vaccine is very good for small animal model. But when you use the monkeys and humans, the very low immunogenicity you can induce. So we need to do electroporation at the same time. We inject DNA in the muscles. Immediately, I followed injection DNA, we have to apply electroporations. Fortunately, this device was made in China, and currently is already in the phase two for immunotherapy using DNA vaccine against hepatitis B vaccine. And this is the device here. The needle is disposable. So if you have want interest, you can see the needle here. It's disposable. And the needles are made from material, the same we use acupuncture needles. It's very cheap and very low cost. So every time you do electroporation, you throw the needle away. It's disposable. So this was made in China and already in the phase two clinical trials. Efficacy data for our DNA vaccine for immunofilled TBs. We use small animal model. We have done several times, and 40 to 50% therapy efficacy was obtained. And this is done by ourselves, but we tried to let the National Institute for Food and Drug Control, this agency was authorized by Chinese FDA for regulatory work and also for the testing quality control. So they performed experiment for the guinea pig model. They gave the report, it's 33%, your DNA alone. So my expectation is DNA alone can make about 30% efficacy, but plus with anti-TB drugs, you may have a higher efficacy, about 40 to 50. Safety data. Before you submit application for phase one, you need a safety data. So in a small model, 1,500 times dosage was used in mice. It's safe. And allergy is safe. And for the long-term toxicity in monkeys, 750 times the dose was used, all safety. So the efficacy was good, and the safety test was passed. So we are ready to submit. The conclusions. So 85A plus B was effective against MDR-TB infection, and with chemotherapy, have a synergistic effect. And the safety of the DNA vaccine was safe for long-term toxicity in humans and monkey models. An electroporation device is needed, but it's already in the phase two clinical trial. So with these combinations, we are ready to submit the application SFDA for clinical trial next year. The business model of my company. First, we call it talent. The China, 20, 30 years ago, we carried out the open policy. So we have the talent, the plan, encourage the students to go back to China to work on the research high tech. And the financing support for this, we call 12 and 11th five-year plan. That means for this kind of three disease, only HIV, TB, and hepatitis. So they give you a five-year cycle plan to support you. If we did good result, they give you continued second of five support. If we go to clinical trial, you get a third five trial. For 15 years long period, you make your product available. Also, the government invests money to make an incubator. A lot of hardware can use it. Yeah, this is the incubator in Wuhan we are now, and the buildings is very beautiful. And also the equipment and the fundamentals and water system is very beautiful. It's 800 square meters. We can use it by renting. Use the government funding to support. And we also need collaborations. Domestically, we collaborate institute and university and the government-owned enterprises. It's the international collaboration with ARIES. So Tom Evans, I visited him just the early March, and ARIES very supportive for the phase one clinical trial. As long as I got approval, yes, it's FDA, the Bruce and Evans will help us design the phase one clinical trial. Yeah. The time schedule. So currently we are in submitting the application, and hopefully next year, we can start clinical trial phase one. Yeah. What are needed next? So for phase one to phase three, we need Chinese government support. And also very important is the government-owned enterprise, CNBG. And ARIES. But for private marketing, we need because CNBG is now going to the market this year, next year. Yeah. And the U.S., Europe, biopharmaceutical company as well. It's open, yeah. And this is Dr. Xiaoming Yang, the president and the CEO of CNBG. He was also trained FDA and NIH campus with me at the same time. Now he's back to China. He's much younger than me. So we can pass down our phase one to phase two, three. That's CNBG to finish my job. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And our final presentation will be by Dr. Jadhav from the Serum Institute of India, who's going to tell us about the Serum Institute, which is primarily a vaccine manufacturer, but also about their TB vaccine candidate.
Okay, good afternoon, and thanks, Julia. Had I not met you last year in London, Beijing conference? Yeah, but one lesson I learned from that Beijing conference was, although in one day, $4.3 billion were pledged for the Gavi, all that money is gone. By 2015, there will be additional money required if the Gavi has to fund the existing products. That means if we are talking about introducing a new vaccine, we will have to look out for the additional money, additional funders, donors, international agencies who will commit that this vaccine, as and when it will be developed, it will be used in the programs. Just to give a brief on Serum Institute, founded in 1966, number one biotech company in India and world's fifth largest vaccine producer with installed capacity of over 1 billion doses. When I say fifth largest, because those companies who are manufacturing oral polio vaccine, they are much ahead of us because the billions of doses of oral polio are required. But if you remove oral polio, then we are the largest at the moment. It's a completely privately held company. Business model is based upon mainly built and partner-based approaches. Our strength is consistent innovation in cost, cGMP-complying indigenous production capacity, and the continual focus on R&D. We supply to almost about 140 countries. More than 60% of the children immunized worldwide get at least one vaccine produced by us. Partner to international agencies such as WHO, PATH, UNICEF, Gavi for reducing global disease burden. And significant contribution to the Millennium Development Goal through the global vaccination supplies. One example where I would like to give is that the measles mortality was to be achieved, means 50% mortality as compared to 1999 by 2010 was one of the goal, but which was achieved in 2007, and 92% reduction in the deaths in the measles, particularly in Africa, which was achieved because of the supplies of measles and measles-containing vaccine from Serum Institute. Now, currently, we have so many partners, and you will see that we have got, we partner with private, we partner with foundations, we partner with big multinational companies, NIH, NIV, that is the RIVM in Netherlands, Rhein Biotech, Sabin Vaccine, Syracuse University, and Wistar Institute, Dr. Stanley Plotkin. Just to mention about Dr. Plotkin, in 1988, I met him for the first time and requested him that I need his rubella strain. And the regulatory requirement at that time was such that he said, okay, what are you doing? What exactly you are involved in today? And within 10 minutes, he said, okay, come on, take it. And next week, I flew from US to India with the rubella strain from Dr. Plotkin. With regard to the BCG vaccine, Serum Institute has a license capacity of 200 million doses per year at present. 150 million of the BCG are manufactured by us every year. We supply 90 to 95 million doses of BCG to Government of India and the UN agencies. Approximately 0.6 million doses are supplied for the immunotherapy against the bladder cancer. And this vaccine is available at an extremely affordable price. 70 to 75% of the world requirement of BCG is taken care of SII as on today. As you have seen before the two presentations, that we have got different approaches. One approach is to make a vaccine or a candidate which will be useful for the treating the MDR patients. Another approach is to treat the HIV patients mainly as a booster dose because this existing vaccine is not effective in the adults. And as I have said that the existing BCG vaccine has a limitation as it can't be used as a booster dose since its live organism remains for a long time in the human blood circulation. It gives mild protection against infants against miliary tuberculosis. It can't be given to HIV-infected patients and immune-compromised patients. And rise of MDR cases leaves only one option to efficient vaccination. Therefore, we have collaborated at the moment with the VPM, Germany, for the tuberculosis candidate, which can be used as a prime and a booster dose. So our approach was that even if new vaccine is developed, if you can't replace the existing vaccine, then there will be two vaccines in the program. And we don't know how the governments and the international agencies will react to have two different BCG vaccines in the program. The reason for the failure of BCG is BCG protects children less than 6 years. It fails to stimulate the right combination of T cells. It fails to protect properly. BCG only induces poor Th1 and Th17 immune response. BCG only weakly induces multifactional T cells. But BCG evokes safety issues in immune-compromised individuals. BCG persists for a long time in body. It kills several immune-compromised mice, severely immune-compromised mice. And BCG negatively influences the weight gain in the neonatal rabbits. And that's why when we went for this new collaboration, we have found that they have got a subtype, which is BCG subtype from Prague. It is genetically modified. The listolysin forms genes are inserted into the bacterial genome. This helps to improve the cross-priming and also cells don't stay in macrophages. There is no interference with the TB diagnostics, induction of CD4 and CD8 plus immune response, induction of multifunctional T cells, and safer than BCG to immunocompromised species and vaccinees. What does the safety mean in context of BCG immunization? The only severe side effect of BCG vaccination is disseminated form of the BCG, which is also known as BCG gonosis. This occurs only in the immune-suppressed individuals and associated with the persistence of BCG in the individuals. To prove the advanced safety profile of VPM-1002, also for immunocompromised individuals, the following experiments were performed. That is, it was used in BALB/c mice for general safety, SCID mice for the lack of adaptive immune system, INF knockout mice, and the newborn Himalayan rabbits. And everywhere it was found to be absolutely safe. I think I will skip this slide because this just gives you the more technical details. The preclinical studies which has been done so far on this candidate vaccine, that the 6-month toxicity study in guinea pigs, including one PPD skin test, successfully completed. No adverse effect, normal weight gain. 42 days safety studies, highest dose 1:4 in guinea pigs. In live phase, successfully completed without adverse reaction. Rabbit toxicology, successfully completed. Newborn rabbits, weight gain study completed. Safety studies in the immunodeficient mice, 105 days completed. Protection and challenge in the murine model, successfully completed. Safety in macaque, also successfully completed. Now, this vaccine is already is in clinical trials. So the first vaccine enrolled on September 8, 2008. Phase 1 clinical trial completed in Germany in about 80 volunteers, which includes BCG-naive as well as the population who have received BCG injection. Phase 1 completed in 24 volunteers in Africa. In both trials, the vaccine shows safety as well as improved efficacy based upon IFN gamma and all other related assays. Phase 2 in infants is ongoing. Up till now, there are no safety issues. See, what we expect from this product is that there will be no interference with the TB diagnostics, induction of CD4 and CD8 immune response, which will give better protection, and induction of multifunctional T cells for the longer protection, and safer than BCG in immunocompromised species. So it will be also safer in the high-risk infants. I think this I can skip. This was shown yesterday. But VPM-1002 is currently the only prime vaccine in clinical development. All other vaccines are as booster vaccines. So this is again what I have already said, which is to show just a comparison that how benefits we might be getting after this vaccine completes the phase 3. And what are the global expectations now from us as a company, that the great developments have been made to establish development and manufacturing capabilities in developing and emerging countries. However, significant barriers and relatively new vaccines still exist. Collaborative nature of relationship between the MNCs and emerging and developing country manufacturer is critical for gaining access to new bioprocessing technologies and know-how. Innovative business models such as JVs and public-private partnerships are becoming models of choice in developing nations. Management of technology transfer issues at early and advanced product development, including IPR, is challenging. And the public sector funders and public-private partnerships will continue to play a pivotal role in advancing R&D and building new product development and manufacturing capabilities. Optimal demand assessment and agreed-upon procurement and distribution strategies, all of which are very critical for the successful delivery of vaccines. Thank you. One last thing I would like to mention is, in my opinion, everything is right or wrong that I have put in there. But for any vaccine to get to the people or to the end user, unless there is a political will, this cannot be achieved. And today in the developing countries, I have seen that with 1% or 1.5% of the GDP or their total budget, which goes for the health, it doesn't speak good. And we don't know what exactly will happen if the international agencies like Gates Foundation don't give their billions or the Gavi doesn't collect their billions for making this vaccine available to the needy people. Thank you.
So I think at this point, hopefully we've given you a flavor of some of the recent progress in TB vaccine development and the state of the field, some different business models, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
A lot has been said in this discussion about the process of commercialization and the development of the business model. But what lies behind that is, it seems to me, the biological reality is that we don't actually know what the mode of action would be of a new vaccine. And it would make a huge difference if it were a vaccine that could be given to people who are not yet infected versus people who are already infected, of course, which are very numerous in the world. So I'd like to get your comments on the difficulties of developing a business model for a tool that you don't know how is going to work.
Any of you want to take that on, or you want me to start?
Well, I think, Chris, it's simply a matter of making the most of what we have and accepting that our understanding of the underlying biology of tuberculosis is poor. We really are scratching the surface of the immunology in terms of understanding a range of issues from, what, and particularly what prompts that reactivation from latent disease state. So I think in terms of where we are at the moment, we have to accept that we have a fairly kind of high-risk pipeline, but results from particularly efficacy studies, which we're now getting into, both with our candidates and shortly for others to follow, these studies should really help inform the field. Clearly, we hope that we get a very positive result in our phase 2b trials. If we don't, that is also going to be valuable for the field. It may not be a great commercial result for ourselves, but I think at the same time, we recognise that there is broader value, and hopefully that will go on to enable us to undertake more rational vaccine design for TB and reduce the risk of kind of technical failure.
And I would just add to that, I think not understanding more of the fundamental biology, certainly not understanding the host protective immune response, is a major technical challenge, but it forces us to take a very practical sort of empiric approach. So the clinical trial designs, the efficacy endpoints, are to prevent disease. You want to show that safety, whether you're latently infected or not, so that the vaccine could be widely delivered. And you hope to show efficacy whether or not you're already latently infected. If we knew that a vaccine were able to prevent infection, if that were the mechanism of action, the trials would actually be much easier, right? Because many more people get infected than get disease, and so you could have much smaller trials. But we're not there yet. We hope that these first rounds of efficacy studies will enable us to identify correlates of protection or at least biomarkers of efficacy that will then help design smarter, faster, more efficient trials in the future. And obviously that we'll learn about mechanism as we go. I mean, vaccine development is a very iterative process. And so what we learn from the clinical trials feeds back to animal and non-clinical experimentation. The results of those hopefully help, again, to inform the design of the next round of trials. It's highly unlikely, I would say, even sitting in, you know, in position of a vaccine developer, that the first generation, the next generation of TB vaccines is going to solve the problem completely. This is going to be a stepwise progression. And we have to do everything we can to learn as much as possible from the ongoing development programs to inform the next generation. Bill.
Typically, from what I understand, vaccine development is a fairly expensive prospect. And I'll just throw a number out there, and you can comment on the number in a second. I'll say it's $150 million, whether that's way too high or way too low, you can comment on, 100 billion pounds. Typically, that's sort of seen as a high risk, high cost, high impact, low financial reward program, which is hard to get funded. And I just would like to hear from, you know, as many of you as can, your comments on where you are currently, what the costs are to get to the next phase, your next milestone, how much you think it's going to cost to get to the end where you're commercializing this, and then really where the money should come from. And I guess I'll just list off for that kind of capital-intensive program of a few hundred million dollars, there aren't that many sources of funding. There's corporate capital, there's venture capital, and there's targeted government spending, but we don't typically think of philanthropy or small people making small donations or small government grant programs as the route to get that kind of capital-intensive project to its completion. So could you comment on, in your view, where should the money come from? Should it come from corporate R&D money or corporate commercial money or venture capital or philanthropy or a targeted government effort, whether a developed world government or the developing world government, to fund the actual R&D, not the purchases, but the actual R&D program?
So 2003, I took back $100,000 to make a vaccine. It's incredible. It's just it's a joke. How could we do that? The idea is, in China, the policy is, we're not going to invest money to develop new BCG vaccine to replace the priming, as Eris does, as Dr. Hoffman does in Germany, because it's impossible for developed country to put long money for new BCG, because BCG is so safe. So you cannot replace one, but they take a long time to research on that. Yeah, Dr. Kaufman worked on 10 years on that. So what do we do with BCG? The areas of contract with Chinese National Biological Group, CNBG, so was without any money to transfer the recurrent BCG intellectual property to China. So now the strain of the recurrent BCG physically was in China, made in Wuhan, used for mentor. Yeah. For BCG project, the government carried the policies not to research ourselves. So only encourage the both strategy, like a DNA vaccine and recurrent protein or adenovirus, is carried as a both strategy. And also encourage you for treatment, MDR-TB patient. I just mentioned, the drug's too expensive. If we can treat 30%, even 20%, it's okay. It can reduce the mortality. Yeah. So how should do? Government funding, especially, I didn't have time to describe the five-year cycle plan for Chinese government. So what it means, since 2011 to 15 years, 2025, to take 3 5-year plan. So our program gets into the support from first of five plan from 2011 to 2005 to 2010. So now the second 12-year plan from 11 to 15. So if our DNA go to clinical trial, they give you the third cycle, the plan to support you from 2016 to 2020. Yeah, I'll tell you, yeah. For what we do only, we only do the phase one. For phase one, the cost in China, one person, $10,000. So if we get a raise in the money from areas, from the government, yeah, so $300,000, we can get phase one trial finished. But at that time, The IRS don't care about phase two and phase three. Tom told me. So that time I have the licensure from Chinese FDA for phase one and also to show the safety. Not big company, stock company, will invest in. So this is our total, only phase one. Then we pass down the phase one result to the big company, the pharmaceutical company, either domestic stock company or internationally. Like recently, the France company, BioMérieux, and also Sanofi Pasteur, they're all interested in what they're doing. They all want to see the efficacy. With the minimum model, we have 50%. The 30% efficacy, they want to see the human beings. If phase one, phase two, you really got good result. You don't have a concern of money for phase two, phase three, and the production in the future. So we want to focus on the phase one, the preclinical and the phase one. The phase one is $330.
Please wait.
So to comment from an OTC perspective, your kind of ballpark figure may well be the kind of numbers that we require even to get from phase 2B to market, and that's just in one indication, such as the scale of phase 3 trials likely to be required. And I think the reality is that funding for these late stages of development are going to have to come from a whole range of different sources. There's no single funder that's going to put their hand in the pockets for $100 million phase 3 trial. And again, it needs to be a combination of probably different public funding sources and also clearly the private sector. I very much agree with Zhong Min's comment that there's a real drive from pharmaceutical companies to show clinical efficacy before they'll really commit to these kinds of programs. And obviously that's a massive challenge because the cost to get to that stage are huge. So I think that's a difficulty for any TB vaccine developer looking to really bring in private sector interest. It's clear that a commercial market does exist for a TB vaccine, but you know it's not the next anti-cholesterol drug. It's relatively modest.
Did you want to say something?
No, I think what exactly okay. Adam said. Just to add on, because these figures are deceptive. For different product, they are a different way. And it all depends upon the regulator, what kind of clinical trial he is going to expect from you for phase 3. It's just a comparator or it's the efficacy trial. If it is the efficacy trial and if you are to enroll thousands and thousands of children, then the cost can go up to almost about $100, $200, $300 million. So we are not yet come to that stage of phase 3, but the proof of concept on phase 1 and phase 2 is there, and therefore if maybe WHO decides tomorrow that they want to change over the existing BCG vaccine with the newer vaccine, then we can definitely see a good possibility of foundation getting and investing some money in this product for the phase 3 clinical trial.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe just one other comment in terms of attracting private sector interest. I think if you really look hard for the right partner and think slightly laterally about what are the value you might create for them, and I'm kind of talking from the perspective of this obviously coming from academia and needing to bring in that commercial partner. For example, with Emergent, we were able to find a partner that was already developing the platform using the MVA viral vector. So clearly this had value beyond TB to them. So, I mean, it may not be that there's an Emergent out there for every academic TB vaccine, but I think if you know, kind of think beyond the confines of the product itself, you open up other opportunities.
Yeah, and I think from the IRIS perspective, you know, our experience has been that development of TB vaccines is high risk for the obvious reasons. But there is a commercial market. There are private sector partners who are interested. So a number of the big pharmaceutical companies, for example, are working on TB vaccines, often in partnership. But if ARIS can play the role, for example, of de-risking a project by helping in the early stages, both through its expertise and by bringing in government, Gates Foundation, other private foundation partners, then if you get through the proof of concept and can really show safety and efficacy, then a corporate partner is much more likely to at least play a significant role in co-funding, if not fully funding, phase three development. So again, I think the partnership roles are very important throughout the whole pipeline if this is going to work.
Put you all on the spot and ask you each, what's your best guess for when, if everything goes to plan, when each of you would say, here's the vaccine you can use? How many years?
I think it's likely to be, depending on the size of the phase three trials that we need to conduct, it may well be another 6 to 8 years.
Yeah, I would say, looking at the portfolio, our sense is if everything went extremely smoothly, the first candidate could be ready by 2020. But things would have to go very well for that to happen.
I think for therapeutic vaccine, probably be faster, because you only love with children and inborn. So the patients, a lot of patients want to be volunteer to test themselves. So well, to see the DNA vaccine in conjunction with the anti-TB drugs for phase three, and to see if we can help with the spread of positive to negative and the cavity to be easier to cure, and different parameters to see the efficacy. I think within 5 years we can get it available, yeah, if it's good.
Thank you. Considering the very long process of clinical trials and, the dynamic environment from various perspectives, like technological turbulence or even regulatory turbulence, could it be the case by the time you finish the clinical trial, the environment changed dramatically already, and you need to incorporate those changes? I mean, by the time you finish the clinical trials, there might be technological advancement that could make it more affordable to people. I mean, how dynamically capable you are to incorporate those constant changes, or it's not the case in such an environment, the industry clock speed is not that fast here, is it?
So I'm not sure which technological advances you're imagining that would happen so quickly that in the course of moving, for example, from early phase two development, when you pretty much need to begin to lock down your manufacturing and process development, that by the time you're through phase three, there'd be an entirely different way of doing it. But the reality of vaccine development is that your process development and your manufacturing procedure is an integral part of what that vaccine candidate is. Okay. So that it would essentially be a new candidate if you change that manufacturing or delivery process. So you'd have to go back through, significant clinical trials with that new approach.
Okay. So you stick to what you developed for, whole 10 years?
Well, you stick to it through the process. If it's working, if you think it's a valuable product, you would probably go ahead and take it to market. In the meantime, you're always working on backup candidates, essentially, on the next generation. So hopefully you're incorporating those technological advances in your next round of candidates that are coming through the pipeline.
Okay. How about if the regulation changed from some aspect? Have you ever encountered such a case where regulation changes in a way that you need to change your path?
So one of the important things about product development is engaging with the regulatory authorities on an early and ongoing basis throughout your process. Regulators also don't change on a dime. Mm-hmm. So that if you're talking with the regulators and getting advice and input from them all along the way, it means they've sort of bought into what you're doing. By the time you get into a phase three trial, essentially the FDA or the EMA, if you go to them, will be aware of how you're going to conduct that trial. And while they never make any guarantees in advance, they let you know if they think that you get robust data out of that trial, whether it's going to be approvable. So you get that feedback and input all along the way during the process so that it would be unusual to get caught suddenly with some regulatory change that you didn't know was coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Following up on this of the regulatory changes, they might be for the good because they might accept, for instance, a marker that can facilitate and speed up the process. So it could in drug development, there is a very strong tendency now to work with companion diagnostics. Is this happening in the vaccine field as well?
So certainly in the TB world, there's a lot of crosstalk between the diagnostics developers, the drug developers, the vaccine developers. Being able to screen populations and to accurately diagnose TB is a crucial part of conducting a good clinical trial. So that's built into the process, essentially. The vaccine developers are not, to my knowledge, I don't think in any case, also the diagnostics developers. But we need to be aware of each other's progress. Your point about ultimately regulators accepting biomarkers as an endpoint is something we all look forward to. We hope we'll get to that point because it would certainly simplify, lessen the cost of, and quicken clinical trials. But that's a long process in and of itself and requires its own validation following discovery or identification of a potential biomarker. So again, it's not something that tends to happen overnight and will really most likely come out of the drug and vaccine efficacy trials, the discovery of a biomarker like that and ultimately the ability to validate it.
But we're certainly making use of some of the new diagnostic techniques. Yeah. In fact, we introduced into our HIV positive adult phase 2B trial the gene expert device in order to improve sort of case detection.
Well, I'd like to thank to our speakers for their inspiring speeches, and I also want to invite you for the lunch. It will start in 1, so make sure that you get there in time. And yeah, thank you.